The year is 1925. America is in the midst of the Roaring Twenties. This was a time when prohibition reigned and speakeasies and bootlegging were the norm. Gangsters, flappers, and ragtime flourished. It was in July of this year that the country was to face an event that would alter the lives of Americans for decades into the future.
Extra. Get your paper here.
Hey, boy, what's on the front page today?
You don't know? You need a paper, mister.
Yeah, but what is it? Another train wreck? Was there...
No, there's a big trial going on in Tennessee.
Oh, yeah?
Some teacher's being sued for saying that we come from monkeys. It's really something. They've got a guy who ran for president.
William Jennings Bryan?
Yeah, and some big-time criminal lawyer. Darrow. I guess they're both in the team.
Sounds big.
Big? Are you kidding? The story's everywhere. I heard that it's nothing short of a carnival outside the courtroom.
Welcome to Scopes Creation on Trial, a Back to Genesis special. I'm your host, Jim Long, and joining me is Dr. John Morris, author, lecturer, and scientist with the Institute for Creation Research. Today, we'll tell the true and exciting story behind the Scopes trial based on actual transcripts of the court case. We'll reenact portions of the trial and be joined by historians as they expose the intrigue surrounding this infamous event.
Jim will also hear from experts in law as they give their perspectives on the trial. And we'll hear from scientists who refute the evidence used during the trial.
Dr. Morris, why a special on an event that happened in 1925?
Well, Jim, although the trial took place decades ago, it still affects us today, and in ways you might not expect. Bible-believing Christians were ridiculed unmercifully by the media and made out to be fools. And as a result, Christians everywhere abandoned the public arena and gave up the opportunity to be salt and light in the community.
You're tuned to Chicago's Voice for Radio. Now let's return to the first ever live broadcast of a court trial, where it sounds like things are heating up.
Mr. Bryan, who is a student of the Bible, what the Bible really means in connection with evolution. Mr. Bryan has already stated that the world is not merely 6,000 years old, and that is very helpful to us. And where your evidence is coming from, this Bible, which goes to the jury, is that the world started in 4004 B.C.
You think the Bible says that?
The one you have taken in evidence says that.
I don't concede that it does.
You know that that chronology is made up by adding together all of the ages of the people in the Bible, counting their ages, and now then, let us show the next stage from a Bible student that these things are not to be taken literally, but that each man is entitled to his own interpretation.
The court makes the interpretation.
But the court is entitled to information on what is the interpretation of an expert Bible student.
This is resulting in a harangue and nothing else.
I didn't do any of the haranguing. Mr. Bryan has been doing that.
You know absolutely you have done it.
Oh, all right.
Mr. Bryan doesn't need any support.
Certainly he doesn't need any support, but I am doing what I conceive my duty to be. And I don't need any advice. If you please, sir.
Dr. Morris, the Scopes trial took place in 1925, but what was going on in the country just prior to that time?
After World War I, America rushed into the 20s with the thought to celebrate life. German higher criticism had entered universities and churches, and new ideas about human origins were blared abroad. Earlier discoveries of the so-called missing links, like Neanderthal and Java Man and Piltdown Man, they were becoming familiar to many Americans. The 1922 unearthing of Nebraska Man gave Americans their own national symbol of human evolution. As a result, many Christians grew fearful that their children would be taught evolution as fact and be pulled away from their parents' traditional beliefs. Thus, anti-evolution laws gained momentum as parents attempted to protect their children.
According to Dr. Richard Cornelius, a professor at Bryan College and a historian of the Scopes trial, the state of Tennessee led the way in this movement to prohibit teaching the theory of human evolution.
Tennessee became the first state to pass a bill that made it unlawful, quote, to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals, unquote.
This Tennessee law, known as the Butler Act, was passed in the early 1920s to forbid the teaching of human evolution in state-funded schools. Former ACLU attorney and now constitutional lawyer Herb Titus says that the American Civil Liberties Union saw this new law as an opportunity.
As a matter of fact, the ACLU saw this as a great opportunity to launch itself as a civil liberties organization in the hearts and minds of Americans. That's why the ACLU ran ads in Tennessee newspapers soliciting a teacher who would challenge this particular law and indicating to that teacher that if he did do that, that the ACLU would provide the financial support to defend him in court and to take this case all the way up to the highest court in the land.
Dr. Cornelius points out that the ACLU wasn't the only one who saw a golden opportunity.
A New York mining engineer named George Rapuier saw that notice, and he recognized the potential of this announcement for solving some of Dayton's economic problems.
The mining engineer was excited about the idea of bringing media attention to Dayton. He immediately shared the idea with the town's pharmacist, F. E. Robinson, who also happened to be the chairman of the county school board.
And Jim, as those two begin to talk, they realize that they needed to meet with other city leaders and form a plan.
What they needed was to find a teacher that would be willing to accept the invitation by the ACLU and be tried for breaking the new Tennessee law.
They asked the biology teacher in the local high school if he wanted to get involved, and he did not, and so they persuaded John Thomas Scopes to volunteer to be the cooperating teacher.
Mr. Wendell Byrd is a constitutional lawyer who has written an article on creation and evolution in public schools. It was published in the Yale Law Journal. He points out that John Scopes wasn't even sure that he had taught evolution.
He wasn't a biology teacher. He was a physical education teacher. He hadn't taught biology. He had only taught one review course for a biology exam.
As a matter of fact, just before the trial began, Scopes instructed two students about evolution in the back of a taxi, so they could later truthfully testify that they had been taught evolution by John Scopes.
You know, Jim, it's interesting to know that Scopes really wasn't the main character in this case. The most recognized figures in the trial were Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan. According to those who have seen the movie, Clarence Darrow was the wise, benevolent agnostic, while William Jennings Bryan was an ignorant, blustering Christian. A careful look into history, though, shows these men to be very different from the accepted characterizations.
Clarence Darrow was a famous criminal lawyer of that day, and he was persuaded to volunteer to represent Scopes during the trial. Herb Titus gives us insight into his character.
Clarence Darrow was the most prominent radical lawyer of his day. He represented a number of people who had been charged with violating statutes in the labor movement. He also made his mark as a criminal defense lawyer. He brought evolutionary theories into the courtroom. He attempted really to transform the common law of America to reflect that evolutionary thesis.
William Jennings Bryan represented the state of Tennessee in the prosecution of Scopes. According to Dr. Cornelius, Bryan was not only intelligent, but also a man who had helped shape many of America's policies.
William Jennings Bryan was a former Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, was a famous orator. He was the leader of the Democratic Party for 15 or more years, and three times was nominated by the Democrats for the presidency. He was the promoter of several dozen measures that we enjoy in the country today, such as women's suffrage, direct election of senators, public parks, Department of Education, and that was one of the reasons he came to the Scopes trial. He was very concerned about social Darwinism and the inroads that Darwinian evolution was making and the consequences of it.
By the first day of the trial, Friday, July 10th, the little town of Dayton, Tennessee was transformed into a beehive of activity.
This once peaceful town had become the focus of the entire world. And outside the courtroom, among all the reporters and spectators, there were hot dog vendors and refreshment stands and even a monkey by the name of Joe Mindy on display. The whole town had become a carnival sideshow.
Gentlemen of the grand jury, on May 25, 1925, John T. Scopes was indicted in this county for violating what is generally known as the anti-evolutionary statute.
The Scopes trial had become a huge media event. Marvin Olasky, professor of journalism at Texas University at Austin, is the author of When Worldviews Collide, Journalist and the Great Monkey Trial. He has this to say about the media coverage of the trial.
The reporters flocked to Dayton from all over. The New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, all had front page stories day after day about the trial, as did various magazines. Radio was just in its infancy there, but there were broadcasts and tapes and so forth. So this was a huge thing in the 1920s because it was seen as Armageddon. it was going to be the end of the creationist, the fundamentalist influence in Tennessee and the beginning of intellectual liberation for the people of the whole country.
According to Dr. Olasky, the media placed its own subjective spin on the events taking place in the courtroom.
Well, what was actually going on in the courtroom was a battle of worldviews, and the media turned it into a battle of smart versus stupid. H.L. Mencken, for example, was probably the most famous reporter there, and here's the way he described the battle. He said, on the one side, that is the Christian side, was bigotry, ignorance, hatred, superstition, every sort of blackness that the human mind is capable of. On the other side was sense. Their goal was not to win the trial. Their goal was to win the battle for public opinion.
Many men stood up in the trial and made persuasive speeches for their side, like Dudley Field Malone, Darrow's law partner.
We shall prove by experts and scientists in every field of scientific knowledge that there is no branch of science which can be taught today without teaching the theory of evolution.
The focus of the trial had completely shifted from whether Scopes had violated the law to a heated battle between creation and evolution. And so by the fifth day of the trial, the defense attempted to call scientists to give evolutionary testimony.
Mr. Wendell Berg points out that
many of us have the misconception from Inherit the Wind and other historical fiction that the case was one in which scientists spoke on the evolutionist side and creationists thumped the Bible. In fact, neither was the topic before the jury. The scientist didn't testify. The first scientist was placed on the stand only to allow the objection to scientific expert testimony. The objection was sustained and no scientists gave testimony.
But in order to preserve this scientific evidence for a higher court in the case of an appeal, Judge Ralston excused the jury and then allowed the expert testimony to be read into the court records by one of the defense lawyers.
Jim, the defense had witnesses in various areas of expertise, the most important being the areas of biology and anthropology and paleontology. Furthermore, many of the proofs used to support the evolution of man are now known to be false.
One of the so-called proofs was that of man's useless organs, or vestigial organs. Dr. Robert Franks is a medical doctor and also a professor of anatomy. He explains this faulty scientific idea.
Evolutionists feel that the human body evolved through various stages and retains vestiges of predecessors of an evolutionary process.
And it was this evolutionary idea of leftover human organs that was presented at the Scopes trial.
Well, see, this is very close to the writing of Robert Wiedersheim's book in 1895, and he had something like 200 vestigial organs in there. And at that point, since they didn't really know how the pituitary gland functioned and all of the things that we now know about the immune system and so forth, they had included still all of these 200 structures as being vestigial.
It's too bad that William Jennings Bryan didn't have the scientific knowledge that we have now.
That's true, and William Jennings Bryan actually turns out to be right when he thought, well, there probably really aren't vestigial organs, but I don't know how to argue against it.